Did you know the Texarkana Gazette has a newsletter for every interest? Sign up at texarkanagazette.com/newsletters to get the news you care about most delivered straight to your email box. You can find out what's happening this weekend, read the week's best feature stories, or catch up on sports scores. Try The Upside, our roundup of good news sure to put a positive spin on your week. There's even an on-the-line newsletter, so you can be sure to never miss the latest episode. And more. Visit texarkanagazette.com/newsletters to customize how you get news today. That's texarkanagazette.com/newsletters. Hello and welcome to On the Line. I'm Carl Richter. Alan West hopes to upset Texas Governor Greg Abbott and win the Republican Party's nomination for governor. The retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, former U.S. House Representative, and former chair of the Texas GOP spoke to me by telephone Friday, 3 days before early primary voting began. I asked him why he's taking Abbott on and about his views on energy policy, immigration, election integrity, and more. One disclaimer, during the interview, West makes specific claims about medical treatment of COVID-19. Neither I nor the Texarkana Gazette endorses those claims, and we encourage everyone to discuss all healthcare decisions with their doctors. I previously interviewed Democratic candidate Beto O'Rourke, and we have invited O'Rourke's highest polling primary opponents, Abbott, and Abbott's other main rival, Don Huffines, to appear on the podcast. Here's my conversation with Alan West. Joining me on the phone is Lieutenant Colonel Alan West on the campaign trail on the road to Galveston. He is running for the Republican nomination for Texas governor. Welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I just wanted to ask you first why you're running. Why take on Governor Abbott? And how concerned are you about dividing the party?
Well, I don't think it's about dividing the party. I think it's about making sure that the party stands up for its conservative principles and the legislative priorities that we put forth as the Republican Party of Texas. And as the chairman, I was very disappointed in the lack of support that we got from the governor and from really the Speaker of the House and from the legislature overall. We wanted to curtail executive overreach because the governor tends to believe that he has the enumerated power to decide who or what's essential and to violate the Texas state constitution by, even with an emergency after 30 days, you're supposed to bring the legislature in. He refused to do that. Changing election law by extending early voting from 2 to 3 weeks unilaterally by himself. Appropriating $290 million of Texas taxpayer money to a MTX corporation for contact tracing. That's supposed to go through the budget appropriations committee. And there are many other things. The fact that we have no movement on school choice, taxpayer-funded lobbying, the fact that we still have this heinous and almost barbaric practice of subjecting our children in Texas to child gender modification procedures, puberty blockers, hormonal therapies, and even having protection for our monuments and our memorials. And even the election integrity law that was signed, we took voter fraud from being a felony offense down to a misdemeanor, and that still has not been corrected. Of course, we know lots of folks have been calling for a fourth special session so that we can codify into law that we will not have vaccine mandates in the state of Texas, and the governor's refusing to do so. So I don't think it's about splitting the party. I think that Republicans in the state of Texas want to see the border secured. They want to see something done with their property taxes. They want their medical freedom to be protected, and they also want their educational freedom to be protected. So that's why I was encouraged to run for governor. That's exactly what I decided to do on July the 4th of last year.
We're right at the anniversary of last year's catastrophic winter storm. you've said you want to keep the ERCOT power grid, the Texas grid, separate from the other grids in the country. I got to tell you, a lot of people here in East Texas were really glad last year that we're not on that grid, and we avoided the worst of the storm. So what's the argument for keeping the grid isolated from the rest of the
Well, the argument system? For keeping the grid isolated is that if we would have people that would not succumb to the corporate interests of the green energy sector, the wind and solar, and they have given it an over-reliance, and it's an unreliable source. You cannot expect wind and solar to produce 23 to 26% energy output for this state, and they failed last year right about this time. As a matter of fact, on the 9th of February, Governor Abbott received an award from a wind energy pack, and of course, on the 14th of February, that's when we saw that failure. So we should be expanding our natural gas with the Saudi Arabian natural gas. We should be going back and looking at those clean coal fire plants that we shut down. I believe it's 3 to 4 of them. And I had some discussions with some students and also professors out in Abilene Christian University. And they're looking at how we can bring in another nuclear reactor, which is very clean and efficient energy source. So I think that we could continue to maintain our own separate grid. I think that's something that Texans are proud of, but we got to make sure we don't have these influences of a energy, scheme or energy agenda that is contrary to what we want to see happen here with the resources that we already have established in Texas.
Energy is one big part of the Texas economy. Governor Abbott's a large part running on the strength of the economy. What issues do you have with current economic policy in the state?
Well, you know, you can sit around and say that you have the 9th largest economy in the world, but we're also the number one state in the United States of America for human and sex trafficking. We're the number, have the top two cities for sex trafficking in the country. That's Houston and Dallas. I don't know why the governor does not want to bring those things out, because no matter how great your economy is, you know, you've got to be able to provide safety and security. And I think that those aren't the type of things we want to be proud of. They're fentanyl that continues to come across our border. The number one killer of people in America, 18 to 45, is fentanyl. And it is brought in from China, and the cartels refine it, manufacture it, and they ship it across the border. We also see the rise of crime. I mean, the capital of Texas, Austin, Texas, is the number 3 in the country for the increase in homicides. And you go down to Houston, we also have a criminality problem with violent felons being released by these judicial activists back onto the streets. 155 Houstonians have lost their lives because of that. So you can tout the economy. That's all fine and well. And maybe that's a good reason why the governor has, you know, lots of corporate contributions and things of that nature. But you get out here on the ground like I have been, and the people are not happy. You think about the folks along the border communities and the border counties, they're living in terror and fear because we have not done anything to provide them any security. We have not done anything to secure our border when you see the federal government has abdicated their duty and responsibility. And so you have this Operation Lone Star, which is just a political optic. And look at the suicides that we've had with our National Guard. Look at the fact they haven't been paid on time. Some of them haven't been paid at all. The lack of equipment, the lack of ammunition, and the fact that they have a rule of engagement that says that they cannot return fire when the cartels are firing across the border. That's an act of war. So it's nice to talk about the economy. We can continue to do that. But there are a lot of other things that have to do with our sovereignty as the state of Texas and our moral standing. Because we should not be leading the way in human and sex trafficking in Texas.
I wanted to ask you about the National Guard at the border. You've said you would deploy guard and state guard troops there to help stop illegal immigration.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, there are some troops down there now. And you mentioned some of the problems that have been recently reported. Mm-hmm. Another issue is that between that deployment and COVID-related deployment, a lot of these people have been on basically active duty for a while. Are you worried about overextending, overusing the National Guard?
No, I absolutely am. And I think that what happened is that the governor rushed to failure. For whatever reason, he wanted to create a political optic, but he did not sit out and plan this thing properly. And look, I was in the military for 22 years, 13 different countries, 3 different combat zones. I understand how to secure a border. I understand how to come up. Right, mission analysis and task and purpose for your troops. That's not happened here. And so when you look at what is going on down there, and again, the federal government has abdicated its constitutional duty according to the guarantee clause of Article 4, Section 4, and Article 1, Section 10, Clause number 3 of the Constitution gives the state the ability and the right to protect and defend itself, as the founding fathers said, when actually invaded. So what we have to do is create a border control zone, Highway 90 to the north, Rio Grande River to the south, and you already have the established sectors, being at the El Paso sector, Big Bend sector, the Del Rio sector, Laredo sector, Rio Grande Valley sector. You deploy your troops down there and put them on the major infiltration routes to be able to interdict this flow of individuals. And you can also utilize the border wall, but it doesn't have to be a contiguous 1,254-mile barrier, but you can put it up in the right places where it does make sense so that you can channel and funnel people into areas you can better control with your ground surveillance systems and also your ground troops. And I think another thing that we have to do is, you know, revoke the licenses of these 501c3 organizations, non-governmental organizations like Catholic Charities and Lutheran Ministries, that are basically the travel agencies for illegal immigrants. They're getting taxpayer-funded grant money to process illegals in the state of Texas, put them on buses or put them on planes, and disperse them out through the country. So that has to stop. So it's that real systemic approach. That's what I talk about with a mission analysis, to look at the key centers of gravity that you can leverage into protecting that and securing that border.
I want to turn to elections now. You've brought it up already. You've called for audits of the 22 election in some Texas counties. You would abolish mail-in ballots altogether. Is election is election integrity really such a big problem that it justifies those kinds of steps? I saw the Texas.
Yes, it does. No, yes, it does. I think when you talk to the people in Harris County, the largest county in the state of Texas, Chris Hollins, who was the county in 2020, should probably be in jail. He wanted to mail out 2.7 million unsolicited ballots. I support absentee balloting. I was a member in the military. I understand what absentee balloting is, but that's a controlled item. Someone has to actually go and request a ballot be mailed to them. But when you're just talking about issuing out ballots without any voter registration roll review, I think we all should be concerned about that. 24-hour voting, that's another thing that Mr. Hollis tried to do. And also curbside voting locations that he opened up in non-Democrat precincts. But curbside voting is very specific in the Texas election law, the Texas election code. So, yes, I think that we do need to make sure that we do have some type of third-party audit system to make sure, as Steve Toth, I supported his bill, the top 13 populated counties in the state of Texas, we need to have a second set of eyes, or maybe a third set of eyes, to make sure that we are safeguarding the thing that men and women like myself have been doing, safeguarding our democracy and this constitutional republic.
Was President Biden's election legitimate, and what is your view on what happened at the Capitol last January 6th?
What happened as far as President Biden's election is cannot be debated that in five battleground states, that's Georgia, that's Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Arizona, there were unconstitutional practices that occurred. And that meant that the governors, secretaries of state, and even judges were changing election law right up to the time of that day. The only people that constitutionally can change law, make law, amend law, is the legislative branch. And so, therefore, I think that we had a big problem, and I can understand why the Supreme Court would not hear the case of Texas and 16 some other states that brought that up. And I've already made a statement about what happened in January 6th, and I get tired of people with their hypocrisy that all of a sudden you can go out and create tens of billions of dollars of damage, you can kill police officers, you can burn down buildings, but that's okay. That's a fine type of protest. So I just want to see equity in how we look at all of these things that are happening out there. And if people did violate the law, then they should be held accountable. But you cannot hold people indefinitely without charging them with some type of crime. And I think that's the thing that we have to be concerned about. That's a violation of your Fourth Amendment rights.
Turning to COVID, how, if at all, did contracting COVID-19 yourself change how you view the government response to the pandemic?
I think it just proved once again that the individual should be the one that is making decisions about therapies, treatments, and protocols for themselves. No one knows my body better than myself, certainly not Joe Biden or anybody else. So, you know, my wife and I underwent monoclonal antibody infusion therapy. And then also I had traces of pneumonia in my lungs. So I was admitted to the hospital. And when the doctor said that he was going to put me on remdesivir, I told him I refused that. And if that's what he's going to continue with, I'd, you know, leave the hospital. And I told him I wanted the budesonide nebulizer treatments. I think I was getting two treatments a day. And in 48 hours, I was released from the hospital. My oxygen saturation levels went from a low point of about 82, 83, and went back up over 90. And the day after I was released from the hospital, I was able to go out and do a 1.5-mile jog. And by the end of that week, I was back to doing my 4 or 5-mile run.
So just to be clear, you have been very straightforward about no mandates at all about vaccines or masks or anything else.
No. Edicts, orders, mandates, and decrees are the tools of a constitutional monarchy. And again, we've got to get back to understanding the rule of law. If there's something that you want to bring forward that needs to go through a legislative process, and there needs to be a law, no elected official, again, has the enumerated power or right to decide who was essential or start to come up with all of these different mandates upon people. Allow people to understand what the situation is. And let's be very honest, we're talking about a quote-unquote pandemic that has a 95% recovery rate. And I think that was a pretty good odds. Talk to the people and protect the people that have those comorbidities that put them at a higher risk, such as diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, heart issues, and make sure that you're protecting them. But to tell healthy people they have to stay locked up in their homes, no one has the right to be able to do that in the United States of America if we follow the rule of law and we still believe in it.
Another issue, you're Foursquare anti-abortion. But I'm a little unclear on where you stand regarding exceptions for rape, incest, and saving the life of the mother. Can you clarify that, please?
Well, I'm not very flippant when you come to these things. I will tell you that I've been one of the strongest pro-life advocates. I've spoken at many different pro-life organizations and groups. And last year, January, when the city of Lubbock wanted to have me as the chairman come out there and support them to be the largest sanctuary city for life in the United States of America, I was right there with them, and I supported them all the way up to that May election, and they are now the largest sanctuary city for life in the United States of America. I think that we have to also consider, you know, those exemptions, but I've already said that if a bill comes to me as the governor of the state of Texas that would end the practice of murdering unborn children in Texas, I would support that. I think what we need to do when you have women that are the victims, their bodies have been criminally violated, we've got to reach out to them. We've got to put our arms around them and let them know that there are services, there are programs that can help them through this, and so they make the right decision for life. But I will tell you that firmly I stand for the exemption where if a woman's life is in danger, and many people agree with that position as well. But I am definitely, without a doubt, not for, you know, the ending of life in the womb. And I will tell you that the community has been most adversely affected by that. The policies of a white supremacist and a racist Margaret Sanger has been the black community. Since Roe v. Wade, 1973, I think we're closing in on 25 million black babies that have been murdered in the womb. But nobody wants to talk about that, certainly not Black Lives Matter.
One more issue. How concerned are you about partisan gerrymandering in Texas? And what, if anything, would you do about it if you were elected?
Well, you know, let's be very honest. The reason why the Democrat Party under Eric Holder, who was the national chairman for the Democratic Redistricting Committee, they spent close to $30 million to try to flip the Texas State House. They wanted to get their hands on redistricting. So, you know, both sides do it, and there's no doubt about it. And I think that in the end result, coming out of this redistricting, I think that the Democrats had a little bit of an advantage in across the country with redistricting. So, you know, that's one of the things about elections. Elections have consequences. It's very interesting to me that when the left wins elections, they believe that they can be totalitarians and tyrants. But if Republicans win elections and they do things such as redistricting or whatever, then everybody wants to get upset. But the Democrats will do the exact same thing. So let's just call a ball and strike a strike.
All right. I know your time is limited. Is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners up here in Northeast Texas?
Well, once again, visit our website, west4texas.com, west4texas.com, and early voting will kick off on Monday, the 14th of February, Valentine's Day. And as I tell people, if you love Texas, make sure you get out there and vote, because there are many people that have sacrificed so that you do have that ability to vote. And Texas needs to be restored once again as the preeminent constitutional conservative state in the United States of America.
When this comes out on Tuesday, early voting will have started. So good luck and stay safe on the trail.
I will. God bless you. Take care, sir.
All right. Take care. On the Line is a Texarkana Gazette podcast recorded in Star Bear Studio, right here in downtown Texarkana, USA. The show was written, produced, and edited by Carl Richter. News stories are based on Gazette staff reports. Texarkana Gazette podcasts are made possible in part by a grant from the Google News Initiative Journalism Emergency Relief Fund. I'll see you next week on the line.